This week on Decentralize, challenges of startup life, Star Wars, and decentralization in the film industry. Then we talk to Nick Sullivan, founder and CEO of ChangeTip.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Chaz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Star Wars. Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars. It's been in the entire tech community. It seems like this has taken over actual projects because, I mean, if there's one thing ubiquitous among geeks, it's their love of TV shows and movies that start with the word star. And I never was much of a Stargate fan or Star Trek, but I love the first three Star Wars movies. And by that, I mean the classic three, not the new three. And, you know, seeing the new trailer, which I went in not nearly as excited and as I thought I would be, but I was actually at the record store and someone said, hey, I just watched it five times in a row, one of the guys that work at Criminal Records. So I was like, I'm going to go home and check this out. I did, and I felt like I was 10 again. There was actual characters I cared about, and it wasn't overly...
The new trailer, right?
Yeah. It wasn't overly theatric bullshit like the last few were, where everything seems grand
the
and
thing
big.
The thing
just
is, like, really...
happy.
God, yes. Obviously, okay. Go watch the trailer if you haven't already, but everyone is so excited about this because it brings back a lot of the same feelings that episodes 4, 5, and 6 had, right? Or, 4, 5, and 6. And the thing that's really interesting to me is they're going back to physical props. Like, they're going back to real stagecraft.
So cool.
Like, so much of the feeling and the essence of Star Wars, like, the sort of, like, relatability of it was lost, especially in episodes 1, 2, and 3, just because there was so much CGI. And CGI was great, but it still is very clearly CGI. Mm-hmm. We still haven't quite crossed the uncanny valley into the state of indistinguishability. And that's what's just exciting to me is we're starting to see like the return of handcrafting. The case of the RB-88, I think, is the one of the droids, new droids. It's like a it's a rollerball with like a with a floating like thing on the top of it. And there was a presentation separate from the trailer where they brought the droid out onto the stage, and it's like leaning and like it's like you're looking at this thing, and it doesn't look like it's even possible to exist. It's fantastic, and yet here it is. It's a real stage prop that's actually operating and is actually moving around. And it's like, there's not even a person inside of it. It's totally a remote-controlled, sort of counterbalance, counterweighted thing.
So cool.
But it's so cool. Like, they're back to this place where they're just building these things themselves.
See, yeah, this trailer really crossed me over from being sort of more of a mild observer of maybe Star Wars culture to being an absolute fan. Just the trailer alone. And I think Eric's observation is really correct, and I didn't notice this myself until they actually brought it up. They're like, there's something different about the production going on here, about the feeling they're trying to evoke, about the nostalgia, and about sort of the anticipation. So they are obviously doing new things, J.J. Abrams and Disney, and I think with Chaz's note of production, I mean, if you look at more recent films, we're seeing sort of like, that's jump the shark to have the big explosions, have CGI. I mean, look at Peter Jackson's like third Hobbit movie.
Yeah,
it was panned. And like, you know, I'm probably more of a Lord of the Rings like fanatic than a
Blasphemy.
Star Wars one. but I didn't even go to see it. I just sort of gave up on it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I thought the original trilogy was quite well done for like cinematically. But as soon as you sort of move toward this CGI primarily CGI focused movie making, it just loses that magic.
It does. Yes. Yeah, go ahead, Eric, sorry.
It's really cool because the thing that made the original trilogy, 4, 5, and 6, so magical was there wasn't any space opera out there that, you know, had this sort of iconic feel.
That's not true. 2001. Okay, 2001.
Was that before or after?
Before.
Okay. So that was
that was Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick.
And
right.
It's a little slow, but...
No, I think 2001 was a fantastic film.
I agree,
but... Star Wars like set the bar. They innovated a lot of new things. They built all these physical models. Everything was in person. There was like very little post processing that was done to sort of bring out effects. All the post processing was being done was traditional, you know, film post processing, not special effects type things. They set the bar for how to do these types of things, and subsequently, every single film about, you know, any type of space opera since then has been taking pages out of that original trilogy's book, and it just lost it, right? Like, you know, you've got George Lucas going back trying to, you know, regain his, you know, chops to build this film, and he really fell short of the mark. And I think that speaks volumes about the sort of cult mentality around a personality, the cult's personality,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And that it is about a lot more than just one person.
Yep.
And it's in the team that he assembled for the original 4, 5, and 6 was really what brought things to the table. These people really cared, like, deeply about their craft.
Yes.
Right? And then, you know, 1, 2, and 3, it was, oh, let's do some production and let's put this thing together. And that's what he lost. That's what he missed. Yeah. And I think that maybe it's J.J. Abrams that's, like, saying we got to get the right people to do this. Maybe it's just the right people want to work on this because the people who grew up watching this have now gone through a career, have learned how to do this, and they're like, this is the only chance we're going to get. We got to do this right. Like, right. I guarantee you, like, almost, if not all, of the people who are working on that movie are fans,
oh, yeah.
Like genuine fans of Star Wars. There's, it comes out in the trailer.
It does, and there's so many things I want to say right now. That's why I'm like rushing to jump into this conversation because I'm so excited, and I need to prioritize in my mind before I speak because it will come out as verbal diarrhea. But I will say this. First and foremost, I think that the Star Wars films are massively overrated. Wait for it. I also think they're some of the best movies ever made. Here's why they're overrated. First and foremost is that everyone loves them beyond any other sci-fi movies. Yes, they're influential. Yes, they are better than most sci-fi movies. But the degree that people love them is a little insane. Wait, there's more, and I'm done saying they're overrated because, to be fair, the new 3 movies did everything they could to piss on it and to make people hate it. That's why when you said that, I wanted to say, let's just pretend those don't exist. In my world, in my head, those movies do not exist.
But that's not the point. The point isn't that they're the best sci-fi films out there. The point is that they're the most iconic.
Yes, I would
okay,
agree.
That's the point, is that they...
And the story's awesome.
The story is pretty good. It's got a few cliches in it, but...
Oh, yeah. It's
but
motifs.
That,
what good
but
story
they're
doesn't?
Motifs. That's a good way of putting that. They're motifs. And the narrative is woven well. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that there are many things that have replicated what Star Wars did because it was so successful. And I think that's the measure. And the parallels that I'm drawing before about people caring about their craft and doing these things, it directly related to entrepreneurialism, product development, art. If you look at anything where somebody cares deeply about what they're working on, and you give them that freedom. Yeah, it really shows. And it is impossible to replicate that, right? And what George Lucas pulled together originally was magical,
right?
It was magical because the people cared about it. And you can't replicate that, and nothing has since.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to throw in before we're not talking about this anymore is a recommendation, because I was looking this up on Wikipedia. I looked up Lucasfilm, and it reminded me of a movie called THX 1138 that came out in 1971, and it's Lucas's first major film, and it was really, really good. I haven't seen it since, like, probably 10 years, but I think in the next week or so, I'm going to go out of my way to watch it again, as it's really great. And, you know, what you said earlier, and this is a separate topic, about the CGI effects, I agree. I think that's passé. I actually think it's been passé for a past decade, except in mainstream movies, i.e. Transformers, people love that. And I don't get it personally, because to me the story's so bad that, like, all I'm thinking is, wow, the story's bad and acting's okay, but I don't care about this movie. Versus you watch Star Wars and you go, okay, the acting's okay, the story's great, the special effects for the time were great, but also remember, if you've watched Star Wars in the past 15 years, you're watching one of Lucas's edits. And the original's even more beautiful. To me, you know, watching an old film is so beautiful. Like, George Millais, the moon film, I can't think of the name of it, and it's killing me, from, you know, what is it, 100 years ago? That thing's beautiful. There are so many beautiful films that existed before CGI, and it's nice to see that being brought back. And I'm glad you dropped that knowledge, Eric, because I had no idea that they really cut back on the CGI for this film. I think that's another positive, and it actually has me excited for a movie. And that does not happen much.
One of the other, if we're talking about recommendations, and this actually is another space opera, it was a very maligned film, but Dune, 1984.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Battlefield Earth.
No, give me a little bit more credit than that. So Dune, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not the one that they released, but the one that, you
director's
know...
Director's cut.
Well, there wasn't even an official director's cut because David Lynch, the director, absolutely refuses to even talk about Dune.
I love David Lynch, though. Have you seen Eraserhead?
I loved Eraserhead.
I want to give you a high five like you wouldn't believe right now. That is a great movie. Anyways, continue.
So the thing about Dune is that it's a really long movie. Mm-hmm. And I think, I just don't quote me on this, but I think the dollar amount was about $1 billion spent on this film. And it was never finished. So the studio, in an attempt to sort of salvage it, I'm not really a film buff, but I really love the Dune universe. Mm-hmm. So like I read a little bit about this, like, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And apparently the studio, in an attempt to salvage it, right? I mean, it had tons of like real hand-grown, like handcrafted, you know, special effects. They just like cut a bunch of films out, or a bunch of scenes out of it, and just like try to condense it down to like a 2-hour format. And it just completely flopped. So it just totally lost it. And then I guess a couple of the editors, like several years later, went back and took the original floor reels that they, you know, all the things that they'd cut, and patched it back together and produced like a four and a half hour version of the film that is like just like way better. It's clearly in an unfinished state, in that there's like things that like they just kind of like bridged the gap because they didn't have the budget, where they just like sketch in a couple things in the film. But it is, if you go back and watch, I watched the extended version first, the one that they had patched together, like the real one, and I was just like, this is an amazing film. And then the next night I went back and watched like the 2-hour version, the official release, and I was just like, this is garbage. Like, this doesn't make any sense. It's not well put together. And it just goes to show that, like, again, that same undertow is when people care about something,
and
it's not about production quality. It's about actually putting your heart and soul into something.
It is. And what else, you know, people may not know about Lynch, and it's funny because, again, I wikied it, and I'm looking at his filmography, and the movie he made before Dune was The Elephant Man in 1980, great film. 1986, he made Blue Velvet after Dune, one of my favorite movies ever. The thing I would say is it kind of also looks like it turned him off from these big budget movies, which is a shame because, you know, he's the kind of person I'd love to give a budget to. And I know that we can make this very contemporary because he is not participating in the new version of Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes you wonder, like, how's that going to be? And I'm a very big David Lynch fan, so I'm very fascinated that you brought him up. And Eraserhead itself, that movie blows my mind to this day. I've watched it multiple times. Same with Lost Highway. Same with Blue Velvet. And now I'm really happy you said that, because now I'm going to track down a version of Dune and watch it. And I can't wait now, because when I first saw it, I got bored and I gave up. My ADD kicked in. So thank you for that recommendation, Eric. And I will recommend to everyone in the audience to check out Eraserhead.
And if you do end up watching Dune, do read the book as well. You miss a lot in any film representation of something. The book of Dune and all of its subsequent sequels are immeasurably monumental. Like, they are perhaps my number one or number two favorite book between Dune, Ender's Game.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm really fairly new to the sci-fi genre. I mean, obviously, like I said, this sort of made me a fan, the trailer alone. And maybe there is something about working in tech and like being around a ragtag group of decentralizing rebels.
Yeah.
Just like in Star Wars. What I really love about this movie is, and about kind of the culture of them, is, you know, the heroes are like entrepreneurs. Han Solo is a bootlegger or a blockade runner. And you have, obviously, you know, I guess you have water farmers, I don't know, something along those lines.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a desert planet, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I need to get acquainted with my economics.
And there's books there, too, that fill in, like, tons of the backstory.
With that being said, so since Eric, why don't you throw out some more recommendations for James as far as sci-fi movies? It sounds like you watch a lot, so.
There's some fantastic sci-fi films, right? Since we're doing the, film and TV show episode of, Decentralize. So Battlestar Galactica, the original, is really good. I actually would recommend watching Battlestar Galactica in reverse order. Watch the new version first, and then go back and watch the old version. Battlestar Galactica has some concepts that are not replicated elsewhere. These sort of like race of indistinguishable human reploids, basically, the Cylons, infiltrating the last remainders of the human race. And then there's this cross-galactic stretch upon which tons of interesting concepts are sort of explored. Battlestar Galactica is really good. Films.
While you're listing more, I will list a couple. Blade Runner is great.
Yep.
Fantastic Planet is an animated movie. Absolutely wonderful. I think it's public domain, so you can probably watch it for free, too. Those two are very highly up on my list. I think more so than that, I'm picky with sci-fi, very picky, although I've heard nothing but great things about Battlestar Galactica as well. There's going to be tons, you know, that we could bring up, and I think you're and do you count, like, The Matrix or Terminator? Do you count those under that umbrella? Because if so, add them, but continue. You're doing more.
There's a series that got canceled called Firefly, and I think it's about 11 or 12 episodes, and then they produced a film to sort of catch up, to finalize, like, because, the people cared about it, and they were like, we can't just, like, drop the show. We have to produce something to, like, finish the story. So they rushed all the, like, remaining story and episodes into, like, one, like, hour and a half, 2 hour long film. And that's called Serenity. And oh my gosh, that's a great one. Farscape is also ridiculously epic. It's a long one. It's like 8 seasons, but it's great. So.
And I guess the last one for me will be Metropolis. Very old.
That's the original. That is the original.
1920s, and they finally found a lot of... Because it was a movie that didn't really exist in its final state for
because
decades.
They lost a lot of the film.
They lost a lot of the film, which is another side project that I love, is restoring old films. I wish I had time to devote to that. And Metropolis is a fantastic film. So, again, we're not just recommending these to James. We're recommending these to our audience. And I do not consider myself a huge sci-fi fan, but I'm enough of a fan to have a few movies that I hold very close to my heart. And with that being said, James, I'm going to let you wrap this up, because you seem like this is new to you. And what movies do you love? And what movies, maybe not necessarily sci-fi related, do you really hold special to you? Because this really gives the audience a chance to get to know us in a different way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really love good storytelling. And I would say, you know, in terms of sort of this maybe more imaginative genre, I do really enjoy, I guess in general, I can't really think of any specific ones, honestly. It's such a long time since I've watched the movie, Tony.
I don't watch many either.
I guess I'm really spending a lot of time sort of reading and discovering ideas, but seeing ideas and what's inspiring about them illustrated in films really exciting for me. So seeing something like these epic battles against, you know, power, centralized power, and something like Star Wars or something, even like Lord of the Rings. I mean, like, you know, big philosophical ideas, but distilled down to things which are really entertaining for people. And
I have to interrupt. I totally forgot perhaps the one that is the most seminal to me.
Battlefield Earth.
No, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
How good is that movie?
Holy shit.
I can't remember the quote.
I completely forgot about it.
It's a great movie.
Don't spoil it for people, but that is a good 1950s era sci-fi film. There's actually a whole, like, swath, like of films produced in the 40s and 50s, and sort of as they sort of start exploring, like, other concepts outside of, like, you know, these long-spanning epics of interpersonal relationships between, you know, like Gone with the Wind and, you know, what's the guy's name? There's a number of films that were pretty iconic for early film. And then this whole, like, wave of sci-fi happened in the 50s and into the 60s. And then Star Wars happened, right?
Changed it all.
It changed everything. And it's just amazing to watch that pivot. And Star Wars is, like, the pivot point. So, sorry. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, so, no, I think... I'm wondering, what do you think is the power of sci-fi? Like, where do you think sci-fi comes from? I mean, it obviously comes at an interesting time in the 20th century when there was a very strong belief in material progress, but also a lot of fear about nuclear annihilation. I mean, that's definitely a very big theme
Red
in
Dawn.
Movies like movies like when Day the Earth Stood Still. I have seen that. I'm not entirely uncultured, decentralized listeners.
No, that's not uncultured. I knew you were cultured because earlier you referenced Casablanca, my favorite movie of all
Casablanca,
time.
Casablanca, that's what I was thinking.
And
yeah.
You said, play it again, Sam, and I was like, it made me smile inside because, you know, there's not many folks my age or younger, I think, that have really loved that movie. So you impressed me there. I think Chaz had something to say.
Yeah, so I don't know if you guys have seen the War of the Worlds film.
War of the Worlds, of course.
That was a great one. The original version of that was actually a radio show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people thought it was real. So many people thought that it was an actual, like, news report, that people actually thought that aliens were invading. This is a true thing, James. James, give me a look. But, yeah, it's totally... People totally thought it was real.
It sounds unbelievable, but you realize...
I've heard they disputed.
Well, no, because radio was... Like, we underestimate, like, how important radio was at the time. This is in an era where people didn't have TV. That's a great movie, Chaz, and an absolutely fantastic story. Like, that is one of those icons of, like, how technology interacts with culture and how it influences society. And, James, you had a really good question earlier about sort of what is the role of sci-fi. The role of sci-fi is to remind us that, you know, we are just a pale blue dot on this earth, and that we need to be imaginative about the things that exist outside of our day-to-day reality, right? So these things are like... You know, we get sort of, you know, dry of the day-to-day process and, like, the people we talk to, the things we do. And it's just like we sci-fi brings something. The reason Metropolis sort of, like, spawned this entire genre for film is because people want an escape.
They do.
And it's the same reason why the genre exists from, like, the 80s, starting from The Time Traveler, right? Like... It was all nonfiction up until, like, 1850, 1860, right? And then suddenly these stories started coming out of very, very imaginative, like, fiction. Like, whoa, wait a second. So this isn't entirely based in truth, and you can have fun with that. You can explore these concepts. So I don't know. Maybe I'm less interested in the specifics of any you know, niche, whether it be film, books, computing technology. What I am interested in is the how it changes over time, yes, and the impact on society over time. And that this is the first time I've actually perhaps verbalized this, is right here on the show, guys. I'm coming to a personal realization.
Yeah.
But I think that is what excites me, is seeing, like, the span of history and the things that are happening in various verticals, and seeing how it changes people and how it changes how people interact, and seeing how it changes people for the future.
Yeah, and the thing I would say to wrap this up in this whole topic of film is the person that you just mentioned that actually did the narration of War of the Worlds on the radio was the gentleman by the name of Orson Welles, who also created, directed, starred in Citizen Kane, which James and I were talking about outside of the podcast. And another film that really changed things from a technological standpoint and really made a critique on media, something that I wish we had a little bit more of today, actually. I'm a big fan of Orson Welles, and he has many other fantastic, fantastic films. So I think that it's not really weird that, you know, he did so many great things, as you would say, Eric, across different verticals, and, you know, really came to become a domineering personality in film. And, you know, with that all being said, we're going to switch off to a little bit more of our regular type. Oh, we're not, Chaz. Chaz just is so excited about all the talk about sci-fi movies. Hey, I'm into it. Let's talk. Go for it.
Yeah, so to kind of segue into the topic of decentralization, because I guess that's what we're all about, apparently. I don't know if you guys heard of this project. It's called Hit Record. Has anyone heard of this?
I've heard of it.
No, I haven't.
Why do I recall this?
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I'm sure you all know who he is, the actor. He has this side project. He's really into indie film. That's kind of his thing. He's been in a lot of indie films, like, growing up. But Hit Record is basically a decentralized film production company. Now, their technology is centralized. You know, they just have a website. But they use this website to collaborate and make films.
Sounds a little bit like a kind of a marketplace for film production work and, like, crowdsourcing ideas. Like, oh, Wikipedia, maybe a Wikipedia plus Open Bazaar or something like that. We really enjoyed talking about this with Naomi Brockwell a while back, about sort of how this power to make films is becoming decentralized. We're going to see a lot more optionality in our films, I think. Maybe, you know, not the big budget ones anymore. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we won't see the same film reproduce over and over again. Maybe we won't see the billion-dollar CGI effects. And it's going to have a lot of... I think healthy trends for reversing a lot of this stuff, which is kind of calcified film. I mean, definitely copyright's been a big one of those. The large input cost of producing a film, just a lot of that's legal inhibitions. I'm just very excited about the creativity is going to be unleashed. I mean, like, you know, anyone can film a movie now on their iPhone. That's, you know, this is true to some extent. We can make a podcast very simply.
Well, that's part of it, right? Is like what we're witnessing right now with sort of like the growth of technology is the democratization of a sort of, maybe democratization is a stigmatized word at this point, but
yeah.
but sort of the increasing availability of these tools to make this content, right? Like the internet, you know, formed this publishing platform. You know, actually, we can even go back to like, you know, home tape recorders, right? The, you no longer need like this massive production studio to produce a recording. You can just use a tape recorder. Imagine the amount of culture and sort of like growth that just resulted from that. And then home video recorders, and then home VHS. Like people started recording family video, home videos. Like that's huge. The amount of content that grew there, and then the internet, and it just sort of like explodes because people can publish. And now we've got all these tools that allow us to sort of create this podcast very easily without having to do these things.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting parallel going back to Star Wars. Peter Thiel makes an interesting observation. He says that a lot of his co-founders at PayPal, they were all fans of Star Wars because it was kind of the capitalist movie, whereas Star Trek was kind of the top-down communist one. It's a very interesting parallel there. I mean, it's what Star Trek represents, and you know, it's not a criticism of Star Trek as a series or anything like that, but it's a very clean, hierarchical, kind of almost sterile vision of the future where technology is passed on from above, where it's, you know, the Starfleet has it and the unadvanced.
Well, there's no currency in Star Trek either.
No currency. And of course, I'm sure Peter Thiel would hate that. But if you look at Star Trek, Star Wars, it's kind of ragtag. It's decentralized. It's entrepreneurial. It's rebellious. It has junk in the future. It's a future full of junk. And I've heard this observation before, but like it's an interesting parallel for what I think we'll actually see in our world and how technology advances. It won't come from the top down.
It's not possible. It violates the laws of relativity, right? So you're going to see a Star Wars type culture, right? Where it, like,
hopefully no empire, but
well, that's the thing though, right? Like, thing about Star Wars is, you know, one man brought down an empire, right? Like, think about that.
I actually wouldn't say this one man.
With help from his friends.
I think the lesson of Star Wars is not
of course
hired guns.
But that's the point, is that you have a much more level playing field and everything is capitalistic. Yeah. I like Peter Thiel's thinking on this. Like, I haven't thought about it from this perspective, but like, that is the universe. You have all of these specialized services. Everybody's, you know, making do the best that they can, and they've got their own little pocket that they've carved out. That is the role of, you know, specialization in a decentralized system or in an anarcho-capitalist system where things are only driven to success through merit, right? Like, the only way for something to truly succeed in any you know, large capacity is by actually delivering merit, right? And that's sort of the future that I'd like to live in. There is
something I want to recommend everyone that's listening and everyone at this table watch is Going Clear. Completely not what we're talking about, but it's about Scientology, and it's about Battlefield Earth and that entire group. I can't recommend it enough. In fact, I think there should be a field trip of decentralized hosts to watch it. While we're on the topic of, you know, very interesting startups like Hit Record, there's an awesome piece recently that ran in Fusion.net about the Crypto Castle, which is actually a house that the Augur Project that I'm affiliated with basically has all of their developers inside. And it's not a unique situation in a startup culture to have something like that, but it is unique in that it's the first building like that that really has a lot of Bitcoin-related individuals that are in and out, you know, guests, media, all that type. And it really got me thinking about different styles of startups and how people work best and just startup culture in general, because it really is something where it's very insular, and if you're working at a startup, you get it. If you don't, you don't. And as someone who was new, I remember distinctively when I first worked with you, Chaz, of bothering you when you had your earbuds in. I did not know the unwritten rule of don't bother them if they have their earbuds in, and I should have. It's common sense, actually, but not so common that I knew it. So with that being said, there was a lot of things that we were discussing off-air that we kind of like save it for the show to go into about this. So what do you think about this? Unique items about startup culture or anything about startups in general that really interest you?
Yeah, no, you know, I probably did the same thing to you, Tony, when I started working with you at BitPay.
If you don't know, it's not rude, but
it's a rite of passage. It's an initiation. Yes. And like these past 8 months have been my first experience in a startup, really, but it's been a magnificent experience. And I'm sure there are a lot of different things about different startups. I mean, that's kind of the point. And if you read the Crypto Castle article, you'll see this one's a very unique one, a very unique gathering of people. But The one thing I do see across startups, or at least across successful ones, ones which really can call themselves that, is an insane passion of individuals to take ownership of the course of the company and to take ownership of, over what they're making. It's very different from working a 9-to-5 or working something where you feel like a passive participant in something. You feel like an active participant in that. And that can be an emotional high, and it can also be a real challenge, especially when you know things are very difficult either for your company or for your work, your workload, whatever it happens to be. And one of the things that I'm very interested in talking to all the guys here about, since we've all been involved in startups in some capacity or others, obviously everyone else a little bit more than me, is sort of dealing with and appreciating maybe that creative chaos that comes with being in a startup environment, how you find ways to succeed and really appreciate that kind of work.
Yeah, so we kind of talk about, you know, startups are a work of passion. Anytime you have, you know, a passion and energy for something, you know, it really comes out in the work. A lot of people, you know, wake up in the morning, you know, they put their shoes on, they take their shower, they put their shoes on, they get ready for work, they roll into work, they kind of sigh and deal with some trouble and some stress, you know, such and such wants X, you know, so and so wants Y, and they go to lunch, and then they, you know, they finish their work, and then they go home. Maybe they leave a little early or a little bit late to avoid rush hour traffic, or maybe they just sit through it because leaving early isn't an option, and leaving late is something they certainly don't want to do. And maybe it's, you know, my perspective as sort of a young person, but looking back at, you know, what I think to be history, it seems like there was this whole culture, especially in the Western society, of, you know, go to work, do your job, and go home, right? And there's like, there's a work-life separation, you know, a family is important, you know, raise your family, X, Y, and Z, and then just go to work and make a dollar and then go home, right? And that was sort of like the corporate culture that developed maybe late 70s, 80s.
I think earlier than that for sure.
Maybe. Do you think that it was earlier? Because I think earlier it was all craftspeople.
I think it's earlier just because it kind of exists on farm time.
Yeah. So yeah. Also true. So maybe post-industrial revolution then is it perhaps a better way of saying
that? I think it's fair.
Yeah. So okay. So the difference between that and like a startup is, especially at the founder level, and I've founded two funded companies at this point, and I've done countless other startups. And there is an ongoing thread, and it is a very clear indicator of the success or the failure of a company or a startup. When you come together and at the very beginning, two founders are just like over the top, absolutely, you know, explosively excited about creating something they think could be really cool, right? There's a lot of different formulas for this. There's, you know, a lot of times if it's a software startup, you got the idea guy who maybe has some business or sales chops, who's, you know, finds this technical guy who's just really excited about an idea and wants to build something. Or maybe the technical guy comes up with an idea or a little thing, and the business guy says, wow, that could make a lot of money. We should really do that. Maybe they have different motivations. Maybe they're just altruists and they want to like make the world a better place. But the thing that ties them all together is an energy that we are really, really excited about this. And what that causes, and when I say excitement, I don't just mean like, yippee. I mean like they wake up, they live, eat, and breathe. The moment they get out of bed, they're just excited about going to build something. And chances are they've been dreaming about what they've been working on for the past couple weeks. They probably just came up in their dreams with like a solution to a particular part of the problem they've been working on. So when they get up, the first thing they do is not put their shoes and socks on, but they open up their laptop or go to their computer and they quickly try to write some things down and try to fix that one problem. And then before they know it, it's like 9:30 in the morning and they haven't made it into the office yet, let alone showered, right?
It's a little bit insane.
No, it is insane. It is totally, it's absurdly insane. It is And it's the only way that these things work is when you have this type of energy. And that energy starts at the founder level, right? And it works your way all the way up through the day. Maybe you forget about lunch. Holy crap, it's 3:30, so you grab a Frappuccino or whatever the hell you want to drink and say, who needs food? I'm just going to grab some more caffeine. And then you work through the afternoon and the evening. Maybe then you go grab a bite to eat, just a quick snack. Maybe it's leftover chow mein in the refrigerator that you ordered delivery the other day, right?
That's what you ate, isn't it, today?
No, not at all. Not at all. I actually took some time off today and went out to eat. And then you work into the night, and then you keep working and you keep working, because if you just keep pushing that boundary, and then it's 12 o'clock and you're like, I can stay up late. I'll wake up late tomorrow. I'll be fine. Or not. Maybe you stay until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, still cranking. And the only way you do that is not because you have a boss over your head, pushing you to do this stuff. It's because you genuinely believe in it, right? Like you defy the laws of logic that, overworking yourself is not going to be a productive thing, certainly not for an extended period of time. Granted, it can be very useful in the short term. And then it's 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and maybe you crash underneath your desk, and that's been the culture in Silicon Valley and a lot of startups for quite some time. And you get up, you go take a shower, maybe at the gym, and brush your teeth, and hey, now you're in that grind, right? And what happens to a company's history is that sort of spirit slowly dives back down to a pragmatism of maybe like 12 hours a day is about right. And maybe we actually start eating lunch together, right? Maybe it's no longer just two co-founders and maybe one extra guy that's helping out, or three co-founders or whatever it may be. And it becomes something where that spirit lives on through the energy of the company and the energy that emanates from the people who founded the company. And the company continues to grow, and hey, maybe it starts to fade a little bit more, and then it slowly turns into that common 9-to-5 job that people are just, taking a paycheck and, sort of leaving at 5 o'clock sharp.
Yeah. What's interesting is that actually mirrors the life cycle of a startup as it becomes a more large company in general, just everything you said. And as a quick reply is, how would you recommend to someone who is in a startup to avoid burnout? Because just what you said makes me tired, and I'm hearing that and I'm like, I want a nap already. So what, any recommendations to those out there who are juggling projects and really have a lot to do, and what can they do to help so they don't get burned out?
Don't do it. Do not work that hard. It is.
That's actually great advice.
It's just work hard, not that hard. James said it at the outset. It's insane. It is absolutely insane to think that, all of those extra hours you're putting in, all that extra stress you are putting on your body, all of those extra chemicals that your hypothalamus is releasing into your body to sort of compensate for that, the food that you're skipping, the sleep that you're dropping, is going to produce anything meaningful ever. All right? You have to take care of yourself. You have to take care of your psychology. You have to take care of your physical body. Healthy body, healthy mind, healthy spirit, and is the only way to combat this. Work hard, right? Work smart, but do not be stupid about it, right? Do not just continue to burn yourself out. There's studies out there, actual scientific studies that suggest that the longest you can stressing out like the degree that I'm talking about before suffering like massive cognitive overload, formerly known as burnout, is about 6 weeks. So if you've got this sprint for 6 weeks or less that you're going to work on, make sure you're saving that energy to just spend it where it's smart, right? But do not just continue burning hard all the time. And that's something that I've been guilty of in my career, and maybe I'm still guilty of, because I still find myself at the office sometimes at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and, busting my ass for something that, could be bigger, right? I think could be a very big deal. And I just want to get it finished so that tomorrow morning when I come in, I can show people like, all right, here it is. I got it working, and move it to the next stage of the project, right?
It's such a strange combination of like the Puritan work ethic and an entirely unconventional way of like viewing your work. So, I mean, it's a little bit of, you really are working with a team. You really are a company of individuals. And there's a sense of responsibility to the other people on your team, but it's also obviously very self-responsibility driven. And you see that in the most successful founders and most inspirational stories. But of course, I mean, it is real. That kind of thing does happen, and it's really not that good. It's so I think one of the struggles, I think, for startups in the future, because we're in a time now where the startup has become a cultural symbol. It's become a you know, sort of a motif, I guess. It might be the wrong word, but and that's what people associate with it. It's like, that's how you have to do a startup, or else you aren't doing it right. Like, you're not working hard enough. And I think there's a danger there of bringing those cultural expectations into it. Maybe we could be doing things differently. You know, like, maybe we haven't fully explored yet what the startup can be like. I think in any case, no matter what, and especially like we said earlier, it's going to be where people take ownership and people feel like they're working for themselves, even if they are working for a company in legal terms. So I think that's sort of the way we approach this podcast, and kind of the way we do a lot of the work we do on it. We take a lot of ownership in what we're doing. And we're always excited to kind of see what other startup founders are doing in their businesses, both with their employees and sort of with the inspiration they bring to it. We're really excited to talk to Nick Sullivan of ChangeShip. He has a few projects he's working on outside of it, and he's really taking this concept of Bitcoin microtransactions to the next level.
All right, today we're joined by Nick Sullivan, who is both the founder and CEO of ChangeTip and its parent company, ChangeCoin. He's also an angel investor, a Bitcoin startup mentor, the co-organizer of San Francisco's JavaScript meetup, you should totally go, and a self-described creationeer. Nick, thank you so much for joining the show.
Super happy to be here, guys.
We're happy for you to be here, too. So it sounds like you've got a lot of things going on. Like, how do you explain to somebody who's never met you or maybe never heard of you, like, what is it that you do?
That's funny. So I call myself a geek at heart. I'm a four-time VP of engineering, been doing this for 17 years. And what I love doing is taking something that doesn't exist and making it real. That's the joy that I get out of my day-to-day work is the creation. So that's where the creationeer term comes from. And my biggest problem actually living in Silicon Valley is figuring out what to say no to. Because there's always so many great opportunities, winnowing down focus winds up being the biggest challenge that we have.
That's a great answer. In my entrepreneurial experience, that was perhaps the hardest lesson to ever learn is, you know, figuring out how to say no, right? So it seems like your biggest project right now, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in this, is currently ChangeTip. What problem is ChangeTip solving, and, you know, what does it do for the people who haven't heard of it yet?
Yeah, actually, the story is a good one, especially, you know, the stuff that's not necessarily on the website, or digging a little deeper and understanding the history is fun. So I got real excited about Bitcoin the second time. I think we all have that story of the friend that tried to introduce us to it in 2011. We didn't pay close enough attention. That was me. But in August of 2013, I got excited again and really dug in that time, read the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper, got super excited, read the source code. People that have been in the tech industry a while have seen a number of different old world to new tech revolutions, and this is going to be the most amazing one yet, because we're talking about paper cash going to digital currency, and the foes or the incumbents on the other side this time aren't just the record industry or the print industry or Hollywood. This time it's banks and federal government. So it's going to be an epic war. It might take 20 years this time instead of 5 or 10. So I love being at the forefront of super disruptive technologies. I wanted to find a way to get myself in it. Started hanging out on Reddit/r/Bitcoin every day. Almost obsessively. I am a pretty obsessive person. When I get into something, I really get into it. And saw the Reddit Bitcoin Tipbot that was written by a guy named Nerdfighter Sean. And it was, and I can say this kindly because he's a friend and he's actually a shareholder in ChangeCoin now. We gave him some token shares for his inspiration that he gave us when we did our last fundraising round. So I can say that interface was really clunky. It was kind of modeled off of an IRC chat bot where you would send messages to the bot. And most importantly, it was Reddit only. And I thought it was great, but I thought we need this for the whole internet. This idea of sharing tokens of appreciation and gratitude when you see something you like, or real life karma. I know that Alex Ohanian actually talks a lot about the idea of a direct connection between someone's contribution at a social level to their lifestyle. There's a really good science fiction book called Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom by Cory Doctorow that walks through this concept of woofy, where there's this direct connection between how good you are as a person and the quality of your lifestyle in a future where the current constraints around the flow of money have been removed. And so I want to create that sort of system online. It's when you see something you like, why does Britney Spears get more money than a social worker who's actually having a meaningful impact on people's lives? That system seems odd to me. So if I can create a mechanism where when someone's doing something online that's moving people, we can have a low friction payment mechanism for that person to be able to be supported by the people who appreciate it, that's exciting to me. So I started building Change Tip in December of 2013, actually at the end, probably January 2014. We launched on Twitter, Reddit, and GitHub as the first three channels in March, and it's been somewhat off to the races ever since then.
So Nick, what have been some of the most interesting applications you've seen in the ChangeTip platform since 2014, and how has it measured up to your expectations or the uses you thought you would have?
Yeah, it's always great when users surprise us, you know, so I think the giveaway threads has been great. You know, lots of people will just decide they're going to give $1,000 away, and actually that doesn't happen too much anymore because I think the novelty of that has worn off a little bit, but people getting excited about it. I think one of the more interesting ones that stretched our brain a little bit and was quite a surprise was, well, actually, backing up a step, when we're talking about the content production and consumption value chain, that's fairly well economized right now by the concept of likes. Each platform has this established economy of a like, and that's the currency, if you will, on the given platform. But it doesn't really mean anything. It's just very, very points. The way that content is monetized right now, unfortunately, is advertising. And so the online advertising ecosystem has inserted itself into the middle of this content production and consumption value chain. I think there's a better way, which is when somebody produces great content, we just need a low friction payment mechanism that allows people watching that content to view it. I want to skip every YouTube pre-roll video ever by saying, yes, Google, I'll pay you half a penny to not watch this because my time is more valuable than that. And that's 10 or 100 times more than Google is making by forcing me to watch it. What we're missing is that payment mechanism. So, sorry, that was a little bit of a background. Just as the online advertising ecosystem has inserted itself into that value chain, on the direct user acquisition, loyalty, rewards, the cost per acquisition front. So Facebook and Google and other CPA-based advertisers, they've also inserted themselves in between product owners and e-commerce websites and the end user because they're that bridge there. So when we start to talk to people that roll deep in Facebook advertising, for example, they get real excited about the idea of when they say, well, wait a minute, so instead of paying Facebook $5 to have my user try something out, I could pay the user $5 to try something out, and eyes light up and they get real excited. And what was really cool was before we had even really thought about that idea, someone on Reddit did it, and they said, "Hey, I'm a startup. I want feedback from my website." So they put out a thread that said, "Go to the website, come back here, leave a comment with some feedback, and I'll tip you." And the guy filled up the thread with hundreds of great, high-quality comments, and he was tipping them each like 25 cents, a dollar, a very small amount of money. If you tried to do that on something like Facebook, A, you'd pay a lot more, and B, the engagement would be a lot lower. So I think it's a great example of low-friction payments and then closing the gap between the product owners and then the people that are using the products. So that was probably one of our bigger surprises. of 2014. It's shifted the way that we think about this a little bit.
And, you know, something that I actually had the pleasure to work with you on was the Bitcoin Bowl campaign, where we were able to get a lot of, you know, some higher profile folks sending out tips and you're really just engaging the community who were, you know, providing good content. A follow-up to that was the artist response. They did really like the way that they can, you know, monetize and really just, you know, find a new way to get it, to get, you know, a dollar or two from fans, and they were very interested in it. But what you're seeing now is other companies are getting into this space. I know that very recently, I believe it's Snapchat, you know, with Venmo coming out, and there was another one I think recently that are accepting microtransactions. Are you viewing these as competition for artists, for writers, for anyone creating content online, or are you really trying to define ChangeTip as something that's specifically cryptocurrency and are going to stay that way? Because I think that the future is really bright on this, but it's a matter of, you know, where are you seeing yourself in a year when a lot of these other systems are more, you know, rolled out and more established?
Yeah, great question. So ultimately what we want is to create a micropayment infrastructure for the web. I happen to believe, and we've got some early proof points, that Bitcoin is the best payment channel for that to happen. There's a few reasons why. One, its peer-to-peer nature allows for transactions to be very efficient, both in terms of, but since there's a quote no middleman, anytime you introduce a middleman, there needs to be some fees charged. So allowing for peer-to-peer payments reduces transaction fees to near zero. We're actually off-chain for the tips. The only time it hits the blockchain is when you deposit and withdraw. So for us, tips are going further. They're free and instant. The second reason for Bitcoin it being a great channel for microtransactions is that it's a currency neutralizer. I don't necessarily have to know if you're rupees or pesos or the U.S. dollar on the other side. You could argue that the U.S. dollar is almost a currency neutralizer because it's so ubiquitous. But and then the third reason is the anonymity. I don't need to know anything about your banking details in order to be able to send you money. It's good enough to just know that you are this person on Twitter, which is why we support the social auth logins. So those three reasons, I believe, make Bitcoin the best candidate for the payment channel for microtransactions. I mean, we've been talking about micropayments for at least the last 20 years now. And, you know, the one interesting question is why haven't they have taken off already? And I think it's not only having a low-cost payment mechanism, but a low-friction application of it. So very specifically, the marriage of Bitcoin and social media, I think, is the magic point that we've needed to cross, and that's where ChangeTip comes in. So and why social media is important is that it needs to be an in-flow experience for whatever site I'm already on. If you see that donate with PayPal button off to the right-hand side of the screen, we don't not click on it because we're cheap. We don't click on it because we're lazy, and we do the cognitive load math of, oh wait, that's going to take me off site, break my flow. Is it hooked up to the right bank account? And what's my username and password again? And that's too much work for what I was already doing. But if there's a tip button right alongside like or share, and it's like, oh, great, this is something that I enjoy, sure. There's a point where I believe with everybody, if you reduce the friction around the payment and the amount low enough, that everybody will be inclined to reward content that they appreciate.
That's a fantastic explanation as to the whole marketplace. I think we're going to get some...
Oh, actually, but I, you know, as far as competition, I'm sorry, I gave the background on why Bitcoin's a good choice for micropayments, but as far as competition and USD-based options, I definitely, in you know, one of the things that we have to expect as pioneers when we go and start charging ahead of everybody with micropayments is that when it works, other people pay attention and decide, oh, we should do that too. I know if I was a VP of technology or a senior engineer at one of these large entrenched companies, I'd be working on this as a hackathon if I saw ChangeTip. So, you know, now PayPal, for example, has some challenges if you start to do this because it's 2.9% and a 30-cent fee for every transaction. It's actually, you know, there. So the idea of it kind of kicks it out for microtransactions, it might still be feasible and a good option for sending $5 to your favorite artist if you could lower the friction around that. And that might, that, you know, that's something that we're actually exploring as another way to get money flowing through the system. And another, broadly what we're very focused on from a transaction flow and liquidity perspective is making it easier to top up. And actually, one of the things that I wanted to go ahead and announce today, we'll be releasing it later this week, is we're going to have the ability for users to come to the site and just buy $25 worth of Bitcoin with a credit card. That's been something that I've been chasing down since last May. So it's almost a year now that we've been working on this, and it's been quite a challenge. We're in a unique position amongst all Bitcoin companies to be able to do that because we have three things going for us. One, we have everybody's social data. So we can have an internal risk score around, okay, this person connected their Facebook account, and it's got this verified email, and it's connected this Twitter account, it's got 5 years of history, and so we have some value, and we can use that for internal metrics on, does this look like a scammer that just created three Facebook accounts from Russia, or no, this is a legit person who's actually putting some social risk at play in order to make this transaction because it's a real person. So we've got a few things going for us in the Bitcoin space that make it so that we can get away with small amounts of Bitcoin being bought with a credit card and all the right tools to fight fraud and risk. This is an example of we're actually going to be able to help grow the Bitcoin ecosystem and get more people into Bitcoin who may have been stymied in the past by a multi-day KYC or AML process at one of the other wallets that's got both higher risk associated with what they're doing and has different levels of regulatory scrutiny being placed on them because they're holding much larger amounts. We're under $1,000 for everything that we do, and that allows us to get much further on the regulatory front. So to answer your actual question, Tony, yes, we're exploring other ways to get more money into the system from USD into Bitcoin. And then also on the other side, once you've got Bitcoin on the system, you know, we get a common question now, great, what do I do with it? So, you know, buying gift cards, for example, or having I sent you a coffee, I'd actually like to be able to go buy that coffee. And I'll leave off some of the specifics there, but that's definitely something that we're interested in, is making this more real for people and providing better on-ramps and off-ramps to fiat.
That's a fantastic announcement. That's really exciting. I think that's going to be really impactful for a lot of the people who are currently not yet entirely exposed to Bitcoin. So thanks for making the announcement. That's really exciting.
We hope to be the easiest way to buy Bitcoin.
That's great. That's going to be a big help. So Nick, ChangeTip has received a little bit of criticism for being this sort of, you know, centralized model. We're big fans of decentralization as well. Can you address that sort of that feedback?
I was really hoping that getting through a podcast called Decentralized, I wouldn't have to answer this. No, I'm just kidding. I absolutely knew this question was coming. It's a common criticism. Interestingly enough, we started off-chain, where every tip was a transaction on a blockchain. And we've quickly found that it was, A, frustrating for the tip to take 10 minutes and have that balance be oddly reflected. We looked close from an architectural perspective at the issues of scale and thinking, okay, wait, we're going to do a lot more than 7 transactions. I mean, we already have peaked at well over that during our busiest times. So we don't think it's prudent to overwhelm the Bitcoin network with all of these tips back and forth. The analogy that I use is if you were building a banking or a gambling website, you wouldn't have a Bitcoin transaction for every blackjack hand. You would have one when they sat down at the table and when they left the table. So that's the similar model we use, is you hit the big blockchain when you deposit and you withdraw, but all the tips move around on a free and instant basis. Same thing for a company like a Bitstamp or other exchanges. All of the incremental trades aren't on-chain. So, there are necessary applications of where we're at today based on how things work within the core protocol that require us to be off-chain in order to be prudent about it, at least. Now, that being said, we also love the idea of using some of our capital to push the Bitcoin industry along and help improve it. So Richard Kiss is one of our employees. He is the author of PyCoin, and I think one of the top minds in Bitcoin, particularly from an implementation perspective. And his charge over the next few months is to figure this out. So look at payment channels, which is, I think, the leading candidate for how this is to best be done, but also look at sidechains. We're good friends with the Blockstream folks. And then even explore tree chains. And I've had a couple of conversations with Peter Todd about this. And figure out what the best solution is for us and do what makes sense. And if there's anything missing from the Bitcoin Core protocol that we can do better, then I'm prepared to have Richard spend development resources working on it. So I'm all for centralization. We had to make I'm all for decentralization. We had to make a necessary evil choice based on the needs of our business at the time. So I'm ideological about centralization, but first and foremost, I'm practical about what our business needs to do.
Absolutely, and the centralization we see in change is mostly centralization in your brilliant mind, Nick. So it's something we can get behind. I mean, it's entrepreneurship. It does involve that singular mind, and there is an important aspect to that for anything. One of the things we like to ask about is sort of what you think the future of social tipping is going to be. With this big announcement, we're going to see a lot more of influx into the Bitcoin community, most likely. This is a great exposure point. But do you think one day we'll see even like newer applications in commerce? Like, can I buy a Ferrari via Twitter with ChangeCoin and change the future?
I don't like the Ferrari idea because then that means you'd have tens of thousands of dollars in your change tip wallet. And to be perfectly honest, we don't want that. We don't want to be the savings account. We don't want to be the checking account. We want to be the slush fund, the amount of money that you'd be comfortable, the money in your pocket, you know, like the amount that you'd be comfortable with that because we're dealing with microtransactions. Off the reservation here for a minute. I'm not claiming that we're going to be doing all the things that I'm about to talk about or that we want to, but there are a bunch of different interesting ideas when you really start to wrap your head around microtransactions. So I'll go through a few of those. Oh, and actually, one step back first. I think there are two key use cases for Bitcoin that are better than the existing payment channels. One is in the 1-to-N category, using Peter Thiel's analogy of the 0-to-1 or 1-to-N. The 1-to-N opportunity in Bitcoin, which is when you take an existing behavior and make it more efficient through better technology in a 10x way, is cross-border remittances. I think it makes total sense to kill Western Union. The 0-to-1 opportunity, which is when you're inventing new human behaviors, is in micropayments. And I think in 5 years we'll look back and we'll wonder what we did before we had micropayments. So the first spoke off of this micropayment infrastructure for the web that I think a lot of people get excited about and can wrap their head around well is, we talked about it a little earlier, but content monetization. So disrupt the online advertising ecosystem. And not even in a paywall sort of way, but imagine an interface where you could go ahead of time and you could say, anytime I visit the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, TechCrunch, my favorite blogging sites, not only would I not see a subscription or a paywall, but I would actually get a better experience because I'm willing to pay a tenth of a penny per page view, which, if you know the online advertising ecosystem well, that's 10 or 100 times more than the publishers are making. I get a bill for 37 cents at the end of the month for my web browsing. It's an inconsequential amount of money to me. I get a much better experience. My data is not splayed all over the internet. You know, everybody wins in that situation except for the ad tech companies, and I'm okay with that. The next one that's closely related, but it's actually more about, again, the friction around payments. Think about the freemium model in a product like Evernote. There's this hard wall between a free user and a paid user, and it's because we have this mindset that it's so hard to convince people to spend money. And I I'll theorize or postulate that the reason why it's so hard to get people to spend money is not, again, because they're cheap. It's because they're lazy. They think, ugh, you're going to make me pull out my credit card and you're going to probably charge me more than I actually want to pay. And this is a subscription that I'm going to have to figure out later how to get you to cancel and turn off. So that's all the friction that we actually feel when somebody asks us to pay our credit card. But if it was like, oh, this is, oh yeah, okay, I'll unlock that, and it's a half a penny because I've already signed in to change tip. Sure, you know, I'm not even going to think about it. And so I view this as another way to have the, when you have a low friction payment mechanism, it's kind of the long tail of freemium software, and it'll actually reinvent the way that we think about charging for products instead of having that harsh wall. So that's one of these spokes. I already talked about another one, which is direct user acquisition. The one that I'm actually personally the most excited about is charities, causes, fundraising, donation. So years ago when the Haiti earthquake hit, we saw Google engineers get together and come up with an SMS short code that allowed you to send $10 by just typing in a 5-character. And I think they raised about $4 million. And what was interesting about that is it just showed if you reduce the friction so low that somebody doesn't have to think about it, they'll do it. Then we also saw recently the Ice Bucket Challenge, which tapped into the power and the virality of social media. And what we want to do is be able to pull those two together and have, so what if, for example, you could have donated 10 cents by retweeting something? How much more successful would that Ice Bucket Challenge campaign have been? So this is kind of my passion project along with Victoria Van Eyck. We want to enable micropayments for charities, causes, fundraising, donation this year.
That's awesome. And Victoria definitely has spoken to me about that in the past, and it seems like it's a great idea to raise funds for a lot of different charities. And when it comes to personal passions, obviously it seems like Bitcoin is one we share. And when you mentioned earlier that in 2011, you know, everyone had that friend, unfortunately, I was that friend and the only person in the community that I knew that even had any interest in Bitcoin. I had to do a lot of Googling and figuring it out. But, you know, it was one of those things where technology's always been somewhat of a passion, you know, in different ways and really different technologies, even back to studying Mills, which I did on a weekend 5 years ago. So I guess with that being said, how did you get into technology, and how did something like ChangeTip come to be where you really went past just an interest into, you know, hey, I'm starting a company. Is this your first company? Have you done anything in the past? There's a lot of questions here, but I figured, you know, they're all probably very interrelated because they have to do with something you love and are passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, to tie a few of the earlier answers back together, I'm very passionate about creating things. I'm passionate about disruptive technologies. Putting my idealist hat on a little bit, you know, in my early 20s, I started to get angry when I started watching how governments were run and how everything had effectively turned into a vote auction. The U.S. Federal Reserve Bank has become effectively the most powerful organization in the world, and they have their hands all over the U.S. Congress. And, you know, there was part of me that thought, wow, this system is just fucked and it'll always be fucked. then, you know, later in my late 20s and early 30s, I had gotten to the point where I was a little apathetic because I just figured, yeah, it's just going to be like this. But part of the light bulbs that went off for me when I saw Bitcoin was realizing that so much of that control revolves around the control of the flow and the supply of money. And I know it's cliche to say give power back to the people, but I really believe that at a government and at the top levels of power within our entire planet Earth, the main choke points are people's ability to have figured out how to control the flow of money. So if we take that out of their hands and put that back into everyday people's lives and quote, democratize that industry, I think we actually have the ability to take back government, unhack democracy. So I'm sorry, I'm getting a little idealistic here, but that's why I want to push Bitcoin forward, and that's why I want to see it. This is not just me playing with cool technology. I actually think that this is going to make a huge dent in the very fabric of the way that governments and control structures are derived today.
Nick, you're speaking to the people who actually similarly believe in the same types of things that you're talking about. I think a lot of us have shared similar experiences of being, you know, disenfranchised, and that Bitcoin has woken us up to new perspectives and the reality that, hey, we can, you know, unbreak this system. So I really appreciate your time today and sharing your thoughts on the show for our listeners. Final question, do you have any upcoming projects, things you're excited about? And then maybe if you'll just share, where can people find you online? Obviously, you're on Twitter, but if you've got a website, other website and change tip, this would be the time to share that.
Yeah, so let's see. I'm trying to figure out what I can say without getting my product manager yelling at me for leaking information. We have some very exciting things coming. One that I'm comfortable talking, well, I already gave you guys one, which is the credit card based purchases. One, another one that it's actually live and it somewhat got leaked by Reddit. We haven't really announced it, but we'll do a proper launch soon, is that you can also tip on all Discuss powered blogs now. So Discuss is a supported platform. Another one that's coming out very soon, and I don't want to get, well, no, I'm comfortable that it's going to come out soon, is SoundCloud. You're going to be able to tip on SoundCloud soon. Beyond that, I'll lay a hint, which is when content is upvoted on something like Reddit, that's an interesting signal of its quality. But when content receives a tip, it's a much stronger signal of the quality of that content. And so we've got some ideas for what to do with that, and it's going to be awesome.
This has been an awesome time and an amazing interview, Nick. Our guest this week has been Nick Sullivan of ChangeShip. Thanks for joining us.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at decentralizeall.